This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. No matter how much you choose to give, you'll feel awesome next time you tune in, knowing that we wouldn't be here without you. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Plus, we have great member swag. Show off your HRN pride with a t-shirt, or keep your hands safe in the kitchen with an HRN potholder. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. Caitlin.
Andrew.
I'm cold.
You think I'm joking about moving to LA, right? I'm not kidding. This is too cold.
Well, the whole reason we're especially cold is our heat went out this weekend. We're recording this intro on Sunday, and
we can see our breath.
We can see our breath in our house as we do this because we were too nice to call the technician when we came home from dinner at midnight or so Saturday night and found that the heat wasn't working. And when we finally called the guy Sunday at a nice, normal, civilized hour, he came here and they needed to order a part. So
we have one more day.
We have tonight. And by the time people are hearing this, hopefully we won't have hypothermia. Well, you're going to a hotel tonight.
I can't take it.
I'm going to tough it out because I like to be home with my stuff. I want to be here with my research books and my, I don't know what else. I guess just my stuff. I like to be with my stuff. I don't like to be in a hotel if I don't have to.
I just want heat. I don't care about the stuff. So, all right, who are you interviewing today?
Okay, so today's show is an interview with a wonderful chef named Victoria Blamey.
Love her.
Who we personally adore. Victoria is the chef of Chumley's. And we did a really cool thing, which I'm going to tell you about in a minute. The interview took place in kind of an unusual way. But before we do that, I have to say, for weeks I have been begging for people to review this show on iTunes. And this week the pinata just burst open and some people came through big time. And I just want to share these. Andy at Breakaway says, "Since episode one, I've enjoyed the podcast more and more to the point where I am already re-listening. Can't wait to see who's next." And we should say this episode is being dropped in between our regularly scheduled episodes because I banked some episodes and I actually have a bit of a backlog. So hopefully, Andy, you won't have to keep re-listening because there's going to be more of a catalog of shows for you to listen to pretty soon. I have a couple of ones that we're going to drop in at a greater pace than we usually do, more than one a week. Chef Ben J says, "Being a chef in the Midwest, balancing family and work, I don't get to talk to many chefs at length about the business. This podcast makes me feel as if I'm sitting down with these great individuals and chopping it up. Thank you, Ben." Someone with the name, I don't know what to make of this name, Balls, B-A-L-L-Z, Deep, 420. I'm assuming 420 is not your birthday. You know what I mean, and I know what you mean, and some people listening to this know what you mean, and that's all good. It's great to hear about the struggles, victories, and defeats other chefs go through in the quest to provide the best food and service to the human race. These all, by the way, I can't tell everybody how much I appreciate these. This show, I don't even have a sponsor this first season. Heritage let me on the air without a sponsor. They really believed in the show. And so it's a labor of love. I don't make a nickel on the show. And hearing, these are all people in the industry, which just makes me feel, I can't even tell you guys how this makes me feel. The last one, Brooklyn 238. I love food in restaurants, but this pod covers that and more. Really interesting. Kudos. More women chefs, please. Which today we have a woman chef. We have Victoria Blamey. I have to say, this is our 9th episode and only our 3rd female guest. It is something that I really do feel strongly about. When Jimmy Bradley and I did the Front Burner show, here on Heritage, we couldn't quite manage it. I don't know why in our 3rd season, but our first 2 seasons, I think we were about 50-50, men to women. It's no accident that Amanda Cohen was my 2nd guest of this show. I have to say, there have been a couple of challenges with some people I really wanted to book right out of the gate, but I am driving this coming weekend to upstate New York to interview Elise Cornack, who used to have Take Root Restaurant. So that'll be coming up before the season's over. I don't think Missy Robbins will mind me saying that she's already committed to being an early guest in season 2, which will be right after the new year. And I do also want to say there are other types of diversity that I'm really trying to have happen on this show. There's geographic diversity, which we've done very well with. We've been very lucky. We've had Paul Kahn from Chicago and David Kinch from California and Stephen Harris from the UK. And I taped last week, it's going to air any day now, Massimo Bottura from Italy. I personally am not happy that we haven't had the amount of racial diversity among our guests. That's something that I'm trying to do better on, and I'm talking to several people. So that's very much been on my mind. And, with only, I think, 12 to 14 shows this season, I am doing the best that I can, but there will be Victoria today and Elise Cornack before the season's out. So thanks for bringing that up, Brooklyn 238, because it's on my mind. You gave me a way to talk about it. Okay, so Victoria Blamey, who is the chef of Chumley's and a friend, I have forever wanted to do an interview. And since I started this show, I have wanted to do a shift drink interview where I go after service, meet the chef in their restaurant, have some drinks, and do the interview at an ungodly hour. And sure enough, Victoria and I met at midnight at a recent Thursday at Chumley's. And as we talked, the staff gradually sort of filtered out to the point where she and I ended up shutting down the restaurant together and locking the doors for the night. This is sort of amusing to me, I guess. Is it sexist that I was amused that Victoria offered to wait with me because her Uber came first and she didn't want to leave me on the street by myself? Is that sexist?
It's not sexist because she's tiny.
She's also tinier than I am.
Yeah, that part is funny.
So I should be offended.
I don't know
what I should be. Anyway,
I don't know. It's cute, though.
Victoria didn't want me to like die after doing the interview. It was pretty late. Victoria's story is she worked for some huge talents. She worked for Paul Liebrandt at Cortone. She worked for Matt Leitner at Aterra. She shifted gears after those. And if you don't know, those are two restaurants that would fall, I don't know what you want to call them, avant-garde, modernist. They're in that realm. And then she went to work for Justin Smiley, who cooks in a much more sort of rustic California / Italian style, first at Il Buco Alimentari and then at Upland Restaurant. And then the Chumley's opportunity presented itself. And for people who don't know, Chumley's is sort of a storied speakeasy that has been in and out of business over the years. Maybe you'd liken it to a place like the Empire Diner, which has been around for a long time and sort of come and gone with different owners, but always maintained the same name. And when I was in college in New York, we used to go there, and it's always remained an unmarked, unsigned restaurant back to the days when it was actually a speakeasy. And it still remains that way. And Victoria took all of her background and created what I think is an incredibly distinct menu that sort of miraculously fits into this sort of wood panel, dimly lit, old New York space. But the food, you know, it's very relatable. It's not out there at all. But it does definitely bring into play a lot of the technique and talent that she has and has picked up at these other jobs. And Victoria knows I feel this way because whenever I have her food, I tell her this. In addition to it being delicious, do you agree, Caitlin? I just think it's gorgeous.
I think everything about that room is gorgeous. I love the room. I love her food. Her presentation's incredible. And you've been talking about that shrimp you had for the once or twice a day for the last week.
Yeah, I had a shrimp with ponzu sauce a week ago with a glass of bubbly, and it was I may have had it again by the time this airs. Anyway, this is going to be a long intro. I will say, you know, when I wrote to Victoria, I had this notion that being there late and drinking, it would get kind of, we'd get rowdy, and it wasn't like that at all. You're going to hear this interview. It's two friends talking shop late into the night. We're a little tired. Neither of us nodded off or anything like that. But I my belief always was that getting someone at this hour would lead to real sort of revelation and honesty and a little humor, and the way it would if you were sitting around having a drink at the end of the shift. And that is what happened. So with that, we're going to go bundle up, and I'm going to let you guys start listening to my interview with Victoria Blamey, recorded at Chumley's late night about a week ago. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, so Victoria.
Yes.
I have always wanted to do a post-service interview. I offer it to chefs all the time. And I don't know if they think I'm just desperate to be cool or they just want to go home. It never happens.
Well, I think I'm way more fun than anybody that you have ever interviewed. So that's why we're here.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, what are we drinking? What are you drinking?
Oof. I'm drinking a Negroni with some bubbles on top.
Bubbles on top.
Yes.
Excellent.
Which makes it really mild, by the way.
Really?
So I might need another one.
Yes. And I'm drinking a Manhattan made with Michter's rye on the rocks.
Which I smelled and I nearly died. And yes.
Yes. It's boozy. But uh-huh. I'm loving the sound of ice cubes in the background as we talk.
Like this?
Yes. I love it.
Yes.
Okay, so first of all, we are sitting here. I got to check the time because it took so long for us to get set up. It's 10 minutes past midnight on a Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
You have just come out of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You have changed into your civvies.
Yes, I needed to.
Yes. And so first of all, this is a rare moment. We're sitting here with a chef at the end of a service. How was your service tonight?
Pretty crappy.
Crappy?
Yeah.
Why?
I had not great orders.
What does that mean?
As in, like, plenty of order fires. We have way too many burgers tonight. That hasn't happened in a long time. And pacing was weird. Customers were off. Kitchen was okay, but there was no really, like, a good momentum.
Really? When you say too many burgers, you mean you'd rather people order different stuff? Or
I love when things are more...
it's like one person was kind of slammed.
No. It's just more like, that sounds good. I like, you see, kitchen. I like to have a good variety.
Yeah.
So I love the burger that we do. I mean,
yeah.
I do have a love and hate relationship with it.
Yes.
But tonight was like, almost like someone read Time Out, Esquire, and I don't know what else
Everyone
all together.
Everyone else who said you have like the one of the best burgers around.
Yeah. And then
all came running here and ordered
the
burger.
Yeah. And they were like, oh my God, I have to go to Chumley's and order the burger.
Yeah.
And you were like, why? Yes, that's what happened tonight.
Yeah, but that's the classic scenario, right? When you have a dish that breaks out like that.
I think actually it has changed quite a bit, which I'm very happy about. And it has taken a lot of work with the front of house and the kitchen.
Yeah.
And everything is pretty even these days, even though the burger, obviously, it is a bestseller.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So tonight was just like a rare old school situation that used to happen last year, for example.
Yeah. So can we have a quick burger debate? I was going to save this for later, but the burger's already come up. Okay, yes. This is the burger debate.
Yeah, I know. Okay. We've been through this before.
We've been through this, but yeah. It's a philosophical...
We know resolve, by the way.
We have a philosophical difference.
Uh-huh,
your
yeah.
burger... First of all, tell people what your burger is, because it is a spectacular burger.
The burger. So basically, it's two 4-ounce patties.
Yeah.
We have also a patty that is bone marrow and dehydrated onions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a patty that is about 30 grams, which I always forget how many ounces that is.
Yeah.
Then apart from that patty, we have fried shallots going on top. And we have American cheese. And we have a barbecue sauce, which is made of mango, jalapeno, and coffee.
Yeah.
And basically, when we, fire a burger, you sear the burger on the plancha, and then you have the barbecue sauce on the bun.
Yeah.
Burger goes on, cheese in the middle, bone marrow patty on top, blowtorch, which is a sexy part of like firing the
what
burger.
What do you blowtorch?
The bone marrow patty.
Wow.
Because it's set. So you blowtorch that,
yep.
Starts melting, dripping through the sides, and then you put the shallots on top, and then you put more barbecue sauce on the bun, and then you close that, and then you have the French fries with dried beef fat and green peppercorn. Yeah.
It's awesome. I've had it.
I had it yesterday,
times.
By the way.
You had it yourself.
I had a piece of burger yesterday,
and?
Yes. It was pretty great. Yeah, it's really good.
How
I
do
really
you develop
like
a burger like that?
Have
you been doing some version of that throughout your life?
No, I never.
Or you developed
this
it specifically for this restaurant?
No, this is the first time I ever made a burger.
Really?
Ever
and
in my life.
What was the development process like?
I was at home.
Yeah.
And
in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn Heights, yes. Yep. I live in a one-bedroom apartment on Geronimo.
Yep.
And I was pretty weird at doing my tastings. Mm-hmm. I had two tastings with Alex, Alessandro Borgnon, which is also the owner of Nakasawa.
Uh-huh.
And I knew I had to do a burger.
Yes.
And I had a feeling that it needed to be obviously something special, but I was like, okay, it needs to be a version of what burger I want to eat that I haven't seen around.
Yeah.
And I thought about all the things that I like, which is fried shallots because they're sweet and crispy. I thought about fat because I love fat. So I thought about bone marrow.
Yeah.
And I thought about this barbecue sauce, which is a version that we used to do in Australia when I used to work in Australia.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, you know what? What if I just try this and this and that? And then I was like, me being, I think it's a child of this uptight Michelin world, I was like, how do I make a bone marrow patty consistent all the time so anyone can make it?
Mm-hmm.
And then whoever can come here can have the same burger over and over again.
Right.
And consistency is a big thing for me.
Yep.
So then I was at home. I cooked some bone marrow very slowly on the stove.
Yeah.
It was this beautiful white fat. And I mix that slowly with my hands with also some dehydrated onions.
Mm-hmm.
I weighed everything out, obviously, because I was doing a recipe already.
Right. Yeah.
And I set it in this little tiny Le Creuset pot that I have.
Yeah.
And then I waited in the fridge for that to set. And then I cut out a disc.
Yeah.
I weighed out the disc. And I was like, oh, this is like 30 grams. That sounds right. And then I was like, okay, I have only two bone marrow patties for my tasting. I better not fuck it up.
Mm-hmm.
So can I swear, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay,
go
I'm so
town.
Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, no, you're good.
So then I go to my tasting with two bone marrow patties,
both
of them 30 grams.
Yes.
And I was like, I hope the burger is good. I fired the burger for Alex, and then that was the end of it.
And you hit it the first time.
Well, Rosen, which is our PR, Jessica Rosen, she had to stop eating and come back to the kitchen where I was doing my tasting in the Bronx, by the way, which is the first time that I've ever been to a Bronx.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, you have no idea. And I was like, oh, my God, what? And I was like, just doing what? I was like, okay, I hope it's okay.
Right.
So they loved it.
So I have to say, the way you were just describing weighing it and cutting, it doesn't look like a fussy burger.
It's a fussy burger in the process. And
right,
it's
but I mean, saying for people who want a burger, for people who think, I'm craving a burger, it is a burger that would satisfy craving. It's not like some fancy, it doesn't look fussy.
This is what I like. Not a lot of the things that we do look fussy, but they do have a lot of work.
There's a lot of precision behind them.
A lot of them. Yeah. For everything. Yeah.
So here's the burger debate.
Yeah.
It says it on the menu in a very charming way. What does it say? What's the way you guys say it?
Cheerfully decline
modifications to the burger. So you will not leave anything off.
No.
And you will not substitute anything?
No.
And why is that?
We started doing that, and we were super open-minded.
Yeah,
I have to say that even through like review process. Yeah. So I was getting reviewed, and at that time I would still do burgers with like no bun, burgers no shallots, burger right. no marrow, burger no sauce, burger no cheese.
Yes.
And at one point it got really, really confusing for the kitchen. At one point people were actually eating just patties.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
A patty of just meat, no yeah. bun, no sauce, yes. no shallots, no cheese, no
right.
nothing.
Yes.
And it got really confusing for the kitchen. It was hard to expedite.
Yeah.
And at one point you were also, it felt like a rape, you know? It felt like people were taking advantage of me.
How do you mean that?
Well, at one point the identity, I'm sorry, you said I could say anything.
You can say anything, but okay. I'm not going to try to decipher that. I'll let you explain that to me.
So it felt like people were taking advantage and yeah. people were lying. A lot of people lie about gluten-free.
Allergies, right, right. They make up allergies.
And I understand the dietary, you know, people sometimes want to like have a gluten-free diet just because of it. I get it. That's fine.
Yeah.
But when people say it's an allergy, you know, in the kitchen, I take it very seriously.
Of course.
They will be like a kid having a burger one day and changing like a bunch of stuff, coming back to a kitchen, refiring three times. And at one point it was really difficult for service. And and it's funny, actually, it was a manager in the front of house who said to me, it's like, Vic, why don't we just stop and then don't just do modifications? And I felt, and it's true, which I am the difficult one here, which everyone knows, but I was like, I don't want to scare people off.
Right.
I don't want to make, you know, burger is such a basic thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be that kind of person to say no.
Right.
For the burger.
Right.
But then I was like, I am apprehensive about it.
Yeah.
We've been serving this burger for at least 9 months.
Yep.
And we've been accepting modifications. And now we're just going to say no. And he's like, yeah, just say no. And I was like, you know what? Okay, sure. Let's just do it.
Yeah.
And we did it one time. And, you know, actually more people understood. More people that I actually admire understood the fact that we were doing that.
Yeah.
I'm going to actually say who.
Right.
Which one of them was Coleman Andrews.
Uh-huh.
I've admired Coleman Andrews forever.
Yeah,
so when
me
he
too.
Came here for dinner, I was a groupie, so I came out. I don't usually do this. I came out with a book, and I was like, please, you have to sign my book.
What was it, the Catalan cooking
yeah.
book? Oh, it was, yeah. Well, that's the big classic.
And, and then I said, he had a guest, and she was like, why not taking modifications for the burger? And I had to explain that to her.
Yeah.
And Coleman Andrews like straight away said to me, it's like, why would you? It's
nice.
Such a beautiful burger.
Okay.
You
well, Coleman
have to.
Said that, I'm going to surrender the debate. I'm going to declare you the winner of the debate out of respect for one of my heroes,
uh-huh,
Coleman
just saying,
Andrews.
Just so you know.
Okay. But I am going to email him to make sure that's a true story.
Oh, it's so true. It is so true. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, listen, it's we're sitting here. It's almost 12:30 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
What time did your day start today?
Today was late. It started like 11:30.
Oof. Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been here about 13 hours.
Maybe. I don't know how to count, but yes.
Yeah. Okay. And you're not open for lunch?
I'm not open for lunch.
So what does most of your day pre-service consist of?
Pretty much I come in. I check with Alvaro, who's like my work husband, by the way.
Uh-huh.
He's been working with me for over 5 years since Atera. He used to be a dishwasher at Atera.
Yeah.
And he has grown into a position of prep cook.
Yeah.
And he's the main guy who, by the way, does like 99% of the burger prep.
Uh-huh.
He used to suffer about it. Or like, I mean, he used to like be so upset and stressed out.
Right.
And, you know, he would burn the shallots.
Right.
He would like not do the marrow right.
Right.
Forget it. It was like 5 months of very intense work. So I check on with him.
Yeah.
I give him my time because he deserves it.
Yeah.
We catch up with the orders that came in and everything was fine. And then usually I would check how many covers we have, which I already kind of know because I'm checking Resi on my app.
Mm-hmm.
I go inside the kitchen. I turn the little side light on.
Mm-hmm.
I turn on the oven because I need to do eclairs.
Okay.
Then once everything's sort of set up and I have the shoe butter tempering, I just go and get change.
Okay. And we should say the eclair is not a, that's not a dessert. That is a lobster eclair.
That is a lobster eclair. Yeah, that is my summer snack. So now it's changing into like a waffle and caviar.
Great. Yeah. Okay. So, let's talk about your career.
Uh-huh.
If we could.
Of course.
Okay. You were born where?
I was born in Santiago, Chile.
Santiago, Chile. Uh-huh. And you lived there until you were how old?
17.
Okay. And when did you start thinking about becoming a chef?
Not until I was 21.
What were you doing before that?
I went to college and I was studying history.
And what did you think you were going to do with that?
That's a great question. Probably my mom was wondering that.
Was it just like I needed to declare a major and like you picked history?
No, I was naive to think that I would have been... maybe, you know, a writer of something. I don't know what.
Yeah.
Maybe a teacher. I think I would have been a good teacher. But I think deep inside, I knew that I didn't have a plan with it.
Uh-huh.
I just love literature. I love history.
Yeah.
I used to love reading. I don't do much of that right now.
Just because of time?
Time, and I can't focus as much as I could before.
You're spent when you're done here.
Yeah, so basically if I read, it really puts me to sleep.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I was really good at analyzing. I was really good at essays, mm-hmm. and I was really good at school.
Yeah.
In general.
Did you cook much as a kid?
I did, all the time.
With, like, did you do that with your mom? Or?
I did that. I started cooking when I was, like, 7.
Yeah.
Because I saw this book on the window shelf of whatever in this mall,
yeah.
and it said like learning how to cook with a little teddy bear
uh-huh.
holding like a wooden spoon.
Designed for kids.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So then I was like, oh my God, I want that book. And you know, I was an only child, so my mom was like, okay, let's just go and get it.
Yeah.
And then I started with sweet stuff, and then my mom works for Nestle. So
what does she do for them?
She's a VP. She used to be a VP for confectionery.
Wow.
Now she's in a different division that I cannot tell what it is because I forget.
Okay.
She would hate that, by the way, that I said that. She's been working there for 38 years.
Wow.
So nothing. So since I got that book and started cooking. And then when I was 17 or actually 15, I became vegetarian.
Did you?
Yeah, for 7 years.
This is one of those interviews where I realize how much I don't know about a friend of mine.
Just because I was stubborn, by the way. Because I love meat.
Yeah.
I love fish. I love seafood.
So what happened? Did somebody bet you couldn't be a vegetarian?
Or? No, I just wanted to do something different. I was bored.
Yeah.
I shaved my head. I dyed it blue and became vegetarian. My mom was a little concerned, so she gave me a book called The Vegetarian Gourmet.
Okay.
And she's like, you really need to know how to feed yourself because then you're going to be so skinny and you're really skinny. And I was like, okay. So then I started cooking more for myself and my mom.
Yeah.
And at one point, I was just doing that like 24/7.
Yeah.
So I was staying up until 4 in the morning cooking cake for my mom. I tried to sell this Christmas cake, which I did not make any money.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't sleep for 2 weeks. I was 17, and my mom is like, this doesn't make any sense. I'm going to try to sell this at work, which she did, and then people loved it. And then at one point, a friend of mine was saying, you're wasting your time, and I told you you should be a cook. And I was like, oh, there's no career in that.
Yeah. So how was that looked at in Chile to someone of your generation?
It was very different, you know. It was not very glamorous.
Are there, like, I'm sorry to be so ignorant about it, but are there celebrity chefs?
Yeah,
there?
We do. We do have. I think at the time where this was happening, we had a few celebrity chefs. They were obviously all male. All with a lot of money as well.
How do you mean that?
Well, you come from a lot of money, so then that's how you open a restaurant.
Oh, I see.
You know?
Okay.
In general. But at the same time, it was like viewing not as a very glamorous thing. Like I said, it was just more like, oh my God, you're going to be a cook.
Right.
You know what I mean? Almost like, why? And then Chile in
that
sense.
You're going to be some anonymous worker.
Yeah,
in the back
for like
some,
whatever hours, working like with, you know, dirty pots and nobody cares about you and blah, blah, blah. And Chile is a country who is very classist. If does that make sense? What I'm saying?
Yeah. You mean it's like hard to sort of move among. You're born into one class, and that's
you're
kind
born
of where
into
you're
a class. But also, people like your last name means a lot. It's very British in that sense. You know, where you went to college, where you went to high school, your friends, your last name. What do you do?
Right.
And all those things, they're basically almost like it's like your, you know, it's like
it's
genetic.
Like your destiny.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, so that's who you are. Yeah. Then.
And where did, can I ask? I mean, you brought it, where did you fit in on that? Like, where did your background put you?
Well, my background is upper middle class.
Yeah.
My name, funny enough, is my last name is British.
Yeah.
So it was always like, you know, blame me. And then I would think it's so stupid, you know, because I wasn't like Victoria Perez. And if I was Perez or Sanchez or whatever else, would be like, who cares?
Right.
So people would be like, oh, that's such an interesting last name. Yeah. So they would be like, where is it from? So then you're like, oh, it's, you know, it's British.
Right.
But funny enough, it's like I didn't grow up with my dad. Mm-hmm. I know I have family in England, but I never met them.
Was your dad British?
No.
But his ancestry.
He has half his family's there.
Yeah.
And then that's how Chile works sometimes, you know? Right. That's the ugly side of Chile.
Right.
So when I switched to cooking school, it was almost like the turn. You know, it was like 2003 when things were like, okay, the school where I went was really posh.
Mm-hmm.
And people were like, oh my God, I want to be a chef. And they were like all these cute girls, you know, trying to play chef at one point.
Yeah.
And I wanted to take it seriously, so I was way, you know, more, it wasn't just serious, but, I don't know, I didn't want to seem cute, you know, because a lot of my friends were cute.
Yeah, quaint.
Yeah.
Like it was quaint.
Yeah, it was like, oh my God, I'm going to end up in this magazine. This is a famous magazine in Chile. Like, oh, I'm going to go and work for Bon Appetit.
Right.
Which I don't mean to say. You know what I mean?
No, that's okay.
And that was that. So then I was like, if I'm going to do this and I'm going to switch careers again, this is the last time and I'm going to take it as serious as I can.
Yeah.
Which I actually did when I went to Cambridge. I was 17. I took a gap year.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to study English. And my mom was like, you better take this seriously.
Yeah.
You better not hang out with any Latinos. And I was like, Jesus, okay. You better not speak Spanish. And I was like, okay, I won't.
Wait, what? I don't understand.
Because my mom was like, you're going to take a gap year. And you're going to Cambridge for 9 months. It's like, you need to take this seriously. There's a lot of money invested. And it's very serious. And I was like, okay. So I did that. So I've always been very academic in that point,
right?
You know,
What was it like going to Cambridge?
It was so much fun.
It was fun.
Oh my God, I loved it.
Yeah, it wasn't intimidating at all.
No,
I would think that would be intimidating.
No, it wasn't. I met so many different people. I felt I was, for the first time, I could just be myself. You know, Santiago could be very conservative.
Yeah,
I don't have a conservative personality.
Yeah.
I didn't fit in many places.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you feel like it was, so even growing up, you felt constrained?
Yeah, a little bit, but I think my mom brought me up in a way that I could always speak my mind, and that was very dangerous.
Uh-huh.
So people would call her to school and be like, hey, your daughter said this. And my mom would be like, I understand. Well, and you know, she would try to defend me. So I just felt, I feel free.
Mm-hmm.
With many, many different cultures. I was very excited to the unknown, and it was great. I didn't want to come back. You know, I went back to Santiago, and I was like slightly devastated, always thinking I want to go back out there, you know.
You wanted to keep expanding your horizons.
Yeah. And my mom was always the one to be like, yeah, I understand. You should go. So
when you decide to switch, you decide to go to cooking school and pursue a career, you know, you end up working in a lot of very different places, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've worked, and we'll talk about these in a minute, but you've worked, for lack of a better phrase, you used it before, you've worked in places that one would sort of think of as kind of like the Michelin bait restaurants. You spent some time working under Justin Smiley at Il Buco Alimentari and at Upland. That's a very different style. I mean, I don't know what you would call that. I mean, some people would call that the California style, or but it's definitely a more rustic type of cooking, a more casual type of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
when you set out to become a chef, when you start cooking, when you were in your 20s, did you have a sense of the kind of place you wanted to head for in your career, the type of food you were looking to cook, or were you more just sort of setting yourself off to sea in the world of cooking and you would see where it took you?
No, I was very determined. I had in my head that I wanted to work for the best.
Mm-hmm. And what did that mean to you? What was the best?
The best was fine dining. The mm-hmm. best was the level of service, the level of seriousness, the level of professionalism, the ingredients, the setup. For me, it was like I wanted to work in an environment that was difficult,
yeah,
demanding,
yep,
and could like bring out the best in me. And
so, for lack of a better term, yeah, fancy restaurants, a lot of technique,
yeah,
a lot of precision,
yeah,
pressure,
yeah,
that all appealed to you,
yeah,
okay,
still does,
okay.
Yeah.
So what? How did you go through school?
Uh huh.
And then where do you go from there?
I go to school, and then funny enough, going to culinary school in Chile, for example, was 3 years.
Wow.
And
do you do externships and stuff?
Yeah.
In Chile?
So you would do an internship. So uh-huh. It was in your own country. It was supposed to go somewhere, and then you would have two externships. And the first internship, I was very glad that I got it on my own because nobody really helped me with that one.
Yeah.
The school was supposed to promote and like be able to like find that place for you.
Yeah.
So I found one of the best restaurants in Santiago. I went there. It was a hotel.
Okay.
It was kind of difficult because you would like encounter the cook who's been there for 30 years.
Yeah.
The sous chef who's been there for whatever amount of years that you doesn't even remember anymore.
Yeah.
But funny enough, also I found great people, super open, and I was also the only woman, very male dominated. But it was precise, it was clean,
mm-hmm,
it was organized, it was very professional, and I was very lucky that I ended up there for 3 months.
Was it Chilean food? Was it French food?
It was Chilean French. So okay, meaning like French technique, Chilean ingredients.
Chilean flavors.
Right,
and
yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. But okay, very also at the time, I think without a lot of a new voice, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was more like, oh, let me make this, I don't know, whatever sauce that is French, but with some Chilean ingredients.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was great. I learned a lot. I worked like crazy. And then my second externship was in London,
mm-hmm,
under Gordon Ramsay. He just took over the Savoy Grill at the time, okay, in 2003,
yeah,
with Marcus Waring when they were still together. I actually read an issue of Gourmet magazine from 2003,
yeah,
in February.
Okay.
And I started reading, and it was difficult to get a Gourmet magazine in Santiago because you would only have to go to one store.
Okay, like some kind of international newsstand.
Yeah, it was an international newsstand, yeah, and you would have Gourmet and blah, blah, blah. And
yep,
then I started reading like crazy, you know, and I buy this magazine, and which I still have, and I was like, okay, that's where I want to go. So put my eye on it, email,
yeah,
send a letter to, very old school. And I get a reply like in 3 weeks. They're like, yes, you can come. Yes, everything's fine. Very serious. You
yeah
know, you'll be here from this date and on this date, blah, blah, blah. And I was like over the moon thinking it would be slightly joyful. And then nothing. I just went there, and that was rough. That just changed my world.
How so?
Sure. The hours.
Tell me.
18 hours a day.
Yeah, 6 days a week.
I don't even remember.
For real?
I seriously, the days off would be like sometimes we get a day off, and you will never know. Sometimes it would be two together. Sometimes not.
Yeah.
You would look at the router or whatever, and I was like, "What is that?" And I was like, "Ah, okay, that's what it is." So you would look at this huge calendar, and you're like trying to find your name. I wouldn't see my name, and I was like, "Oh, okay, I guess I'm not off."
Right.
And working lunch and dinner.
Was this like the classic old school thing where you'd work lunch and then maybe fall asleep on a banquette or something like that?
Well,
in the
I think it was actually old school in the sense of like, yeah, you would do lunch, mm-hmm, then you would have a break of maybe 30 minutes. People usually used to smoke.
Uh-huh.
They would go to a cafeteria, which yeah was really depressing. And I was like, I'm not going there.
You mean like an employee?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they were awful. So it was like filled with like just cigarette, like a cloud. And I was
yeah
like, okay, I can't do that. So I would go to a park and I would eat lots of Kit Kats, by the way, because
uh-huh
those are my favorite things, the
okay
UK Kit Kats. I made good friends from New Zealand when I was working.
Yes.
And drink lots of coffee.
Yeah.
Lost so much weight. And then at one point you overcome this, you get over the hump, no? You're like, I was super scared at one point. I was out of my water. I was so green, you know? I was we were two women in the kitchen of like 15 people.
Wow.
Obviously, they put me on garde manger first. I said, I don't want to go to pastry. I was super stubborn about it.
Because you're a woman, they put you on garde manger.
Yeah, but I said, wow. I don't want to go pastry. So it's like, oh, okay, so let's just go to
cold
starter.
So as a woman, it was one of those two things.
Yeah.
That's really old fashioned.
It is, but at the end of the day, also, like, I didn't have experience.
Right.
So,
but
cooking.
I just mean, you talk to people who started, like, in the 70s and 80s, and that was traditionally where...
Right.
If you were a woman and you could get into a kitchen,
yeah.
Those were the two places.
Well, they were still the same.
It was still like
it
that.
It was still like that.
It's amazing.
And then at one point,
I mean,
you
we're only talking like 12, 13 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Okay. Yeah.
And then you just get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after a month, you get used to the hours, you get used to not eating, you get used to getting yelled at. It was difficult to see sometimes, I think, the intensity. I understand that, but I understand that now. I think it's to see, like, someone getting, like, you know, someone's, like, throw a ball at, like, a cook. And you'll be like, oh, my God, he just threw a ball at a cook. And I'll be like, oh, you know, this is insane. And then at one point, I was like, oh, okay.
It's just you didn't even
notice
anymore.
It's almost like the Stockholm Syndrome. It's like, oh, no, yeah, I get it. It's fine. I understand. And that was my first externship, and I loved it. I slept nothing. I made really good friends.
Yeah.
I still actually have my best friend. He's British.
Yeah.
He was my junior sous chef.
Yeah.
I used to chop herbs for him, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I used to be on the herb station.
Yes.
I
like that you pronounce herbs in the British,
yeah,
the British way.
I just stuck with me. So,
yeah.
And it's always so cute. You know, actually, he came here when I opened Chumley's too. He came to help me out. And
oh,
I just
nice.
Couldn't stop looking at him and be like, we met 13 years ago
right.
and I used to do herbs for you. So that was my second externship. And then the third one was in England as well.
I have a question for you. When you were just talking about like throwing a bowl at somebody and all this.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so obviously, you know, we're living at a moment right now where all this behavior is like...
All right, yes.
It's on the way out, right?
Uh-huh.
Don't you think?
Oh, I don't agree with physical
States.
Abuse.
I'm not saying, I'm not asking that. But my question for you is, was there, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Was there any benefit to it?
To the physical throwing the ball at people?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Not that.
Not that.
No, not that. But I do believe there is some old school regime and... structure
toughness.
That does make sense still.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes the lack of that, it doesn't really help a kitchen at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you come into this business, sometimes there's a moment where you need to know that you just say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to say yes when you disagree.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a time when you have to listen to someone who's your commander, basically.
Right.
And... it's funny, you know, I'm the kind of person to argue everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I had trouble in school, in college, and wherever you want to say it. But when
you're
I
a nonconformist.
No, and I will be like, yeah, but, and I'll try to argue and make a case.
Yeah.
My mom thought I was going to be a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
Never happened. But then you go into this world and you understand that at one point it's like you just have to say yes.
Yeah.
And something inside of you changes when you understand... the dynamic,
mm-hmm.
you know, until then at one point it just doesn't make sense anymore.
Right.
So it makes sense for me for X amount of years. And
yes.
then at one point, 12 years in, you're like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
Because I want to be the person to be,
you want,
this is me.
You're the one who says this is how it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes there's always a space for a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a space when you're like in the arena,
mm-hmm.
because that's what a kitchen is.
Yeah.
That is like, no, this
right.
is what it is. And
yeah.
you're in my arena.
Yeah.
And this is how it gets done.
Do you find that that is a more rare mindset now than it was when you were starting to cook?
Probably. But I also think it's very easy to judge from the outside. You know,
yeah.
I think the pressure sometimes overtakes you.
Mm-hmm.
I think the hours, the intensity also make things a little worse and you have a lack of judgment.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to be understanding on the other side, you know?
Yeah.
It's really easy to criticize the asshole who's screaming at you.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to be like, I understand why this is happening.
Mm-hmm. You mean why that person is...
Yeah, why this person's under pressure, why this person's stressed out, blah, blah, blah. But also I do understand that at one point it's like not right. You know, I mean, I've been in both sides. I've been in the side of like, okay, you know, I get it. He's stressed out. I get it. This is not what's supposed to happen. I get this and I get that.
Yeah.
And sometimes you might not get anything, but you still have to be like, yes. Right.
Yeah. I only ask the question because, you know, yes, I agree about the physical part, obviously. But I do, you know, I think if you talk to a lot of chefs who came up years ago, they do feel like kitchens have gotten soft, right?
Absolutely, but I agree.
They feel like it's gotten too touchy-feely. They feel like... Yeah. They even feel like the kind of hours that that you just described, those long days, which are more and more rare, especially with labor laws and all this, they feel like those hours made them better cooks and toughened them up.
I mean,
and I'm not advocating one side or the other. I was just curious to get your take on sort of that aspect, because you kind of did that kitchen you're describing in a lot of ways functioned in
and
what was even then starting to be an outdated way.
For sure. I mean, like, you would listen about, like, hey, you know what? Because we were in Michelin. It was all Michelin World. And Michelin World in Europe is very, very different. So they were like, you know what? Some kitchens, it would be the rumor. And it would be amazing. Hey, did you hear? Tomacans is giving 3 days off. You do 4 days on and 3 days off. And you'd be like, what? That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And I do think, for example, one thing I don't agree with is the hours. I do them because I'm used to it. I mean, I can't do the 18. I can't be here from 7 to closing.
Right.
I think it's been really hard for me to understand this year that I'm getting older. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to understand that the body doesn't work the same way.
You're starting to feel that.
Oh, my God, 1,000%. And it's still, for me, like, I don't get it. And I'm still upset at myself. I keep being upset at myself. I'm a woman. I'm 38, and things have changed. And I cannot agree with that. And I still think I'm 25 and I can work 1,000 hours. I don't really party, you know?
Yeah.
But
and
I
you
feel
take care of yourself. I mean, I've heard you reference, like, you go to exercise classes.
Yeah. I do Pilates 3 times a week. Yeah. I'm generally a healthy person.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, I don't do drugs.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't mind saying that. I just don't, because they never really had, wasn't really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they never really, I don't know. I thought it was like whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I would go to rave parties and I would be up until 6 and I would dance like a crazy animal. And people thought that I was on drugs all the time. And I was like, no, I'm just drinking water.
Right.
But I have a very high stamina and now that's changing.
Yeah.
And I just hate it.
That's frustrating to you.
Oh, I hate it.
Yeah.
I can't stand it.
How long have you been feeling like this?
I would say for like a good 8 months.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And is there anything you can do to, like, if you work out harder or get an extra hour of sleep? I mean, does anything make it better?
No, not really. Yeah. I think it's just more like I can't treat my body the way I used to. Mm-hmm. I can't just, like, you know, don't eat, don't drink water.
Yeah.
Maybe survive with chocolate. You know, probably Paul Levran could tell you how many Kit Kats I used to eat a ton. And that was only recently, and that would be fine. And now it's just like, no, I get tired. My back hurts every now and then. And I think for the years that I've been doing this, I could be in way worse shape.
Mm-hmm.
I can still work a 14-hour day.
Right.
But, you know, at one point, I think it's the stress of opening a restaurant. You feel sometimes like you're like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, I think of alien. You know, and then like the mother egg that feeds all the other little eggs. So you feel like, oh, you are responsible.
Wow.
Well, I love Aliens.
Yeah, so I do too.
It's my favorite movie.
Yeah.
So, and then you feel like, okay, so there's all these things that I need to make sure they're okay. And I think that's when also you realize the lack of time for a personal life.
Yeah.
Because this is your life.
Yeah.
And this is my family.
Yeah.
And
there's no other way to do this job, right?
No, I don't really think so. I mean, not for me.
Yeah.
You know, I even though tonight was like a crappy night and I was upset at everybody, and I was upset and disappointed in the kitchen, and I expected more, and sometimes I'm very demanding and all those things. I do love everybody that I work with mm-hmm. in the kitchen. I feel very responsible when I get upset at someone. Mm-hmm. I wish sometimes I could be better. Mm-hmm. You know, I question myself all the time, and some things for me, they're just the way they have to be. Sometimes someone needs to, if they're in my kitchen, is the way I want them to be.
Right.
I don't want to force anybody to be there.
Yep.
Because that would make no sense, you know. Right. I don't also hate people when they leave. I don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. But if we're gonna be in this together, this is the way it is.
Yeah.
And for me, it's serious, you know. I've given up a lot, and
right.
I love what I do. So yeah.
I want to talk about the jobs that led you here. We're going to take a quick break first, though.
Yeah, sounds great.
So we are chatting with Chef Victoria Blamey at Chumley's Restaurant in New York City. It is very late, but we're going to keep going. Damn it.
Yeah, my drink is done, by the way.
I haven't finished my drink, but I will before this. I vow that I will finish my drink before this interview is over. We'll be right back after this break. Like a four-leaf clover. Like a tanning bride, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
And we are back late night here at Chumley's. With Chef Victoria Blamey. Victoria, before we start,
yes.
You know what I think would be great? I think it would be great if people listening to this show went onto iTunes and rated the show or gave us a review.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be great.
Okay. This is my weekly plea. Uh-huh. It helps people find the show, people. Uh-huh. Please.
So you can find them on iTunes?
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea. I'm sorry about that. Okay,
that's okay.
Well,
I'm a little hurt, but that's okay.
I'll do it. Okay.
Yes, that's right. Well, I'm not asking you to give a review.
No, but I want to.
I'm telling the people listening to us. Uh-huh. Yes. But anyway, helps people find the show. Please give us a review or just a rating. Just a rating. There's stars. just like you do on your, for your Uber driver. Uh-huh. I know. I'm sorry.
No, but it's always a star.
It's always stars. Uh-huh. Well, eventually they'll go away. let's talk about, so here's how I'd love to talk about, the places that led you to where you are right mm-hmm. now. Okay. I feel this way. I think you have a very distinct style. Mm-hmm. And I think your food is delicious. I also think that you have a very distinct visual style.
Oh, interesting.
I do. Uh-huh. So how did you... You know, rather than going through like job by job, but mm-hmm. When you think of over the years that since you started working in some of the places you worked at Cortone with Paul Liebrandt.
Yes.
You worked at Atera.
Twice, by the way, with Paul Liebrandt.
Where else?
No, twice at Cortone.
Oh, you left and came back.
Yeah, I couldn't get enough. I'm kidding.
Well, the funny thing is,
I did the same with Justice.
You know, the funny thing is that you know, when I first met you, mm-hmm. I mean, now I see you socially, you know, we've gotten to be friends and, you know, you're this very vivacious person. When I first met you, it was when I was working on Paul's book.
Oh my God, I remember, yes.
And you were this, like, I don't think I ever heard you say anything except, you know, bring a dish out for him to okay and say, yeah, like, here, chef.
Yeah.
I think that was our entire relationship
probably
for a year.
It was the same with Ellen Sung, by the way. Yeah.
Anyway, so you worked, yeah, with Paul there. You, uh-huh, worked with Matt at Aterra. You worked with Justin Smiley, mm-hmm, at Il Buco Alimentari and, mm-hmm, at Upland. Mm-hmm. You spent time at Mugaritz.
Yep.
Am I leaving out any significant
stops? 2.5 years in England at Two Mission Star.
Mm-hmm.
And Australia and Melbourne.
Yeah,
fine
where did
dining.
You work in Australia?
This place called Interlude. Okay. It closed like a year after I left, I think.
Okay, and, yeah, what was the style there?
Also, tasting menu.
Okay.
Yeah, fine dining. Yeah, hardcore fine dining. I've been hardcore fine dining until I went to Alimentari Il Buco. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you, over these years, start developing your own style? Like, were you cooking your own things in your own time? Were you keeping a notebook of ideas? Were you mentally making notes? Were you in a position to put some of your own dishes or ideas into dishes that were on the menu at these, mm-hmm, places you worked? How did you go about evolving the style that you have?
I think it's a work in progress. I don't actually see myself that way.
Mm-hmm.
I am not sure really what my style is, mm-hmm, still. I think Chumlis has been a vessel of exploring who, mm-hmm, I am. Obviously I keep like notebooks everywhere because, mm-hmm, I love writing. That's right. Because of my other, earlier years of, you know, literature and whatever. I also did some poetry, I remember. And I love writing. I'm very old school. I'm not a big fan of computers, so I would keep books everywhere. But at the same time, I'm very random. I don't know where they are.
For real?
Not for real. Even though I'm super organized, sometimes like, oh my God, I lost that recipe. Yeah, of course, because it was on a piece of paper that I put away in this very specific place that, yeah, I forget.
When you say that when you just talked about, usually when I think of a notebook that a young cook keeps, it's, yeah, recipes or maybe sketches. But when you talk about writing, did you keep more of a journal?
Yeah, I would have journals. I would have different books with just phrases, you know, like ideas, random thoughts. And, uh-huh, I used to draw when I was a kid too, or, yeah, like not a kid, really. I was like 15,
right,
with charcoal. Uh-huh. I used to go to school for that. And so I always keep like books around. Yep. But that wasn't really it. I think, even though I did have, a really great relationship with Matt and a really good relationship with Paul when I was Corton and obviously Aterra, I would give ideas, but I wouldn't really be like, oh, you know, this is a composed dish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the moment that happens is when you have this pressure. I think I couldn't really put my finger on it, but Jessica Rosen, who's, you know, the PR for the, yep, company, she said to me one day, she's like, you are very good under pressure. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like with this like grumpy face. And I was like, what are you talking about? It's just, yeah, like, well, you just like whenever there's pressure, you just perform so well. And when there's nothing going, and it's so true. When I have there's no pressure, when I have an easy life, yeah, when I don't have to do something, I just like, I it's like dispersed, you know? I'm like, I don't know what to do. Yeah. I want to do 1,000 things.
This is one of the things I find that almost you never want to overgeneralize.
Uh-huh.
Every chef I know, I feel like you could say this about them.
Probably. I think it's a chef's
trait. It's come up on this show. I mean, we're only 7 or 8 episodes in. It's come up with a couple of the chefs. Alex Stupak said to me on the very first show,
uh-huh,
that if he didn't have, you know, the three restaurants and all this stuff going on and crises all the time, he'd be depressed.
Yeah, no, it's so true. Like, I love it's funny because, you know, I complain. I was like, oh, my God, it's a horrible day. But, you know, the dishwasher didn't show up. The cook just quit. And someone just chopped their finger. Someone has pink eye. That's just happening right now. Someone has a flu. And, you know, you feel like sometimes it's slightly overwhelmed, but it's not. You know, you're like, oh, I know exactly how to deal with this.
Yeah.
And it's like, it will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
So in a moment of crisis and a moment of, like, pressure and like, hey, there's a photo shoot tomorrow. And I was like, oh my God, but I also have this. And
yeah,
Oh, that's fine.
I'm feeling very guilty for keeping you here. No, after I hours love this. Tonight.
No, not at all. Like if I wasn't here with you,
sounds like just what you needed.
No, yeah. But I
you'd be what, making terrines or something?
I used to, like after like 2 months before, I was like making terrines until 3 o'clock in the morning.
You would after service?
Yeah, because yeah. I didn't have the time.
Yeah.
I couldn't find the time during the day to do it. It takes me 3 hours.
Yeah.
And I remember Justin being, Smiley was here one time and he's like, you're making what? I was like, well, I have to make terrine.
Justin was your old chef at Upland and El Buco.
Yeah, in Upland. And, you know, I do think there's been a gradual change and improvement, even though I complain all the time, because I do. I think things are better.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, things can always be better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's still more to do.
Yeah.
It's the same with myself. So the style that you say, I don't really see it all the time, but...
Is that a good thing, though? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it seems to me... No, the reason I say that is I feel like in any discipline, right? Cooking, writers, filmmakers, I feel like as soon as somebody... I think it's great to have to be able to put your finger on something and define it for... marketing purposes and all that, it's useful, right? From a practical standpoint. But I also feel like very often you'll see, again, a chef, a filmmaker, a writer, whoever, as soon as somebody defines it for them, they can become very self-conscious about trying to stay in that lane, right? They're like, oh, I do this. And they're always kind of trying to hit that mark as opposed to just flowing. Like it seems to me like you're saying that you just flow. Like
yeah, I don't.
You don't overanalyze it. You cook. You have ideas. You hone them. You present them. Is your approach to your menu very? Is it fairly intuitive? Like you just sort of
it is.
Tweak
I think,
your menu the way you would tweak a dish, and until it just sort of seems the
I
way
do
you
know,
want it.
I remember. I always remember people that I used to work for, and there's always something that I'm grateful for with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Matt Leiner saying to me, it's like the moment you're overthinking and the moment that is so hard for that dish to give birth, you just have to walk away.
Meaning what?
Meaning that when you're like, it's not that, it's not the almonds, should I change hazelnut, should I add? Because usually the chef is like, I'm going to add this, I'm going to add that. And it's like, okay, I'm going to take this off. And then at one point it's so hard that there's not like a real flow. Like the burger. I'm telling you, I cannot believe that burger just came out the way it was supposed to, I guess, come out in one shot.
Yeah.
It's just natural.
Yeah.
So the moment something is so much work and thought, then it's like I leave it. I just let it rest.
Not meaning you put it on the menu that way, meaning you step away from it.
Yeah, step away from it. And
maybe
I was like...
Maybe you come back to it another time.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, a lot of things that I do is funny. I think the problem that I have is that I overthink, but also sometimes when it doesn't feel right to me, I can't just put it on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
So if something doesn't feel that it has a personality or a voice or something to say, then I usually always like write it and I was like, okay, that's it. So there's like 1,000 dishes that are like, they're there. And I was like, I'll come back to it.
Yeah. Well, that's a very writerly thing, right? That's what people say. Like put it away in a drawer and come back
to it.
Yeah,
I do that. I come back to it. Sometimes I was like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. So sometimes I'm like, I love that. But that doesn't make sense.
So what do you mean something to say? Like, what does that mean for you with a dish?
It's about myself. I think is whenever I give you something, It's me coming out of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying something to you.
Right.
So the burger, even though I have a love and hate relationship because it's like something casual that I never even used to cook.
Yeah.
And people are so fascinated about it. It's me. You know, it's like it might be complicated. It might be a little fussy.
Right.
Maybe a little sexy.
Right.
Maybe a little this and tasty. Yeah, that's Victoria Blamey.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever comes out of that kitchen is... part of me. So if I'm not saying something to you, it's hard for someone to see myself because there's no face, but there is my personality that has to come out in one dish or another.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. Like someone needs to interpret it.
So this is a hard thing to talk about in a podcast because people can't see it. But when I make this comment, it's the second time I've said it to you, and both times you've seemed surprised. No, am I the only person who tells you this about your food? I think it's very striking visually.
No, you're not. I just, I'm really bad at compliments.
Oh, you know, I think about you, the, you referred the eclair. So you have that eclair, with lobster, and it's served on that little gold foil and it really pops and the scale of it, it's not stingy, but it is small. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very delicate. The burger is, you know, completely the opposite of that. You do a tuna dish. Is it a carpaccio on the menu? Yeah. What do you call it?
No, it's a carpaccio. It's a tuna carpaccio. But that, but it's like a folded sheet.
Yeah. I mean, it's this huge, like red tarp almost.
Yeah, yeah. I want it to be like a messy bed sheet.
You know? There you go.
Yeah.
But it's very striking. I've never been served a carpaccio that looks like that.
Well, I...
How do you go about that part of it?
I think I'm a very vain person. Mm-hmm. And I love beautiful things. Mm-hmm. I like being surrounded by beautiful things. Mm-hmm. I'm not ashamed of saying that, but it's true. I like beauty. I like sensual things. Mm-hmm. I like sexy things. Mm-hmm. I want to be, you know, taken to somewhere just by the way I see something.
Yeah.
So I am, my mom used to say this, like, you eat with your eyes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I didn't have a big appetite when I was a kid until I was like 15.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, oh, but that looks so good. You know, it's like I want things to, I want to crave things when I see them. Mm-hmm. So I want someone to do the same with my food.
Yeah.
And they're not on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But I like.
You don't think about it that much.
No, not really. But sometimes something comes in my head. So sometimes it's like, you know what? I think about a poem. Or sometimes I think about something that happened to me or something that I saw when I was a child. Or sometimes I'm like, I want red. Oh, my God, I'm thinking about white. You know, so things move that way with dishes.
So you'll start sometimes from a visual standpoint when you first think of a...
Sometimes
it'll
be like...
It doesn't always start with flavor for
no,
you.
No, sometimes
you
it's
back
like...
back into the flavor.
I mean, sometimes a combination, but there's a lot of like color, mm-hmm. you know, like... Yeah. Oh, there's red, and I want harissa. So when I thought about harissa, I think about Middle Eastern nights, and I think about this sensual perfume of sandalwood, and I think about spice, and, you know, it takes me to this place.
Yeah.
Then sometimes I'm not, it sounds really obnoxious for people maybe, because I'm not saying that I do a good job of delivering the message, but that is my inspiration. My inspiration has... a color, a theme, a moment, or a thought, or a memory.
Yeah.
So there's always a reason why I'm doing something.
But I would argue, I'd love to know if you agree with this. Yeah. To me, it doesn't matter that the diner can't possibly know all that, right?
I mean, of course not, yeah.
But the fact that it's meaningful to you will affect, what's the word, like the integrity of the dish?
Probably, yeah.
Right? Like
which
the fact
I think is the same,
you,
like if you do it every night. You know, there was this documentary going on like a month ago. And I said to this person, I was like, if I don't...
You mean the one they were filming here?
Yeah, well, I think you were having dinner that night.
I had dinner here
night,
one of those nights, yeah.
And if I can have some part of myself when I'm cooking that night, and if I don't feel excited and I'm not happy doing that dish over and over again... I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And I know it sounds really like...
Precious.
Yeah, precious, slightly dramatic.
Yeah.
But I am that way. You know, I want to feel something all the time. I want to be moved. Mm-hmm. I want to be either... If I'm angry, it's the same. If I'm happy, I'm angry, I'm sad.
Yeah.
There's something going on in every dish that I put out.
Yeah.
But there's no indifference. Mm-hmm. I hate indifference. You know, it's like I grew up in the age of Nirvana. And when people are like, oh, yeah, you just don't care about anything. No, there is something that you're saying.
Right.
That's bullshit. You're like, you know, my parents and what was my mom, older generations, like, oh, you just don't care. It's like, no, I do care.
Yeah.
But this is the way I'm showing you how I care or don't care.
Yeah.
So I wanna feel something. I want to be moved.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes it's a little hard to, I think, go through emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's intense, but I love intensity.
Yeah. So this restaurant, I mean, I talked about it a little in the intro, but you, I mean, this was a speakeasy.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard. I've never been by this. I mean, I never came here yet.
But I mean, this is the kind of place that, you know, it's not the most logical home for what you set out to do in your career.
No, not at all.
So what was the, when you decide to come here, what was the vision that you had for this space? And because your food does sort of, to me, in a very counterintuitive way, fit right in. I mean, it seems to totally belong here. And this, I think, probably has to be part of what you were just saying, right? Like, this is part of the story you're telling in some way that probably isn't clear to me.
You know, all I saw when I came in, I was like, this is an opportunity that it felt very scary to me.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, because it was like, none of the things that you see right here, that which are like very good looking, sexy, interesting, blah, blah, blah. There was none of this. But there was like this space of, with the smell of like beer, which, by the way, I don't drink beer.
Right. You mean the space was dark when you guys came
in?
It
was dark, messy, dirty.
It wasn't a functioning restaurant at that
moment.
Not
at all. Right. It was just a mess. I would go and see the space of the kitchen. I was like, this is a fucking joke.
Right. And we should say, right now, as we sit here, there's leather, studded leather banquettes.
Yeah.
There's dark wood paneling.
Mm-hmm.
There are book covers lining the walls. And then
the
huge
gold,
black and white gold framed portraits of mostly writers.
Yeah, and all very impressive.
Yeah. And I mean, there's Hemingway, there's Fitzgerald, there's...
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what it looks like now. So anyway, when you came into it as a raw space, though, with your background, what was...
I think it was more in the need of, like, I was bouncing and not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
You know, there's... I think now that I'm here and I hear about so many interesting, hardworking, impressive cooks out there that they're like, oh God, I don't know what to do. So they're consulting.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're like, oh, I'm a line cook in the meantime.
Right.
I was at that point in my career that I was like, I don't know what to do. And the opportunity just presented itself.
And you felt very much ready to become a chef.
No. No, but I thought I was going to say a very dirty word. I thought I was going to be a chicken.
Uh-huh.
You can think about another word. If I didn't take the opportunity because I wasn't ready.
So this opportunity presented itself to you.
Yeah.
You weren't out looking for it. You wouldn't.
Not at all. I was supposed to go and be chef de cuisine for someone else in the company.
And you were fine with that.
I wanted to be that not because I wanted to be the chef de cuisine answering to another person, but I wanted to go back into fine dining.
Got it. Okay.
You know, I was working for Justin Alimentari, then he left, and I went to take a trip in South America. It was amazing. Come back, go and work with Justin,
yep.
And it was in the meantime, which he was amazing because he just embraced the fact that I wanted to help him out. And
yep.
Then I'm like, okay, so what do I do now?
Yep.
And I am, like I said to you, I'm not good at being like adrift. You know, it's just like, oh, what do I do now? Then I just can go in so many directions. You
yes.
know, it's awful. So this happened. And I was like, if I'm not ready now, when am I going to be ready?
Yep.
I have 12 years of experience.
Yeah.
I have, for some people, an amazing resume.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, it's like, it's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I can keep going this way. And then when am I going to stop?
Yeah.
It's almost when you want to have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, am I ready to have a baby? You're
right.
Never going to be ready to have a baby.
Yeah. Someone said to me years ago, you're never qualified for the next job.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
The next
thing.
Level.
So
you're,
it's like,
you're never qualified. You've never done it.
You know, I'm like my worst enemy, but I'm a very interesting friend in that way to be like, so why? Why wouldn't you? So I have this debate in my head.
Yeah.
And I always talk to my mom. My mom is my best friend. And I know it sounds cheesy, but it's my best friend in the sense of like, it's my best friend because she's the person that I would believe what she says to me. It's like she gives me amazing advice. She's an amazing professional.
Mm-hmm.
I respect the shit out of my mom. Mm-hmm. She's this strong force that that raised me. And I was like, you know, I was going through a breakup. Everything was wrong.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know. This is a bar. What am I going to do here? So right. I was very aggressive to be like, I'm not doing bar food. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that.
And so then, you were ready to take the opportunity, but it had to be on your terms.
Yeah. So then I was like, okay, I think I have to be ready. It's not mm-hmm. like I'm ready, but I was like, I need to push myself.
Yeah.
So I love doing that. So then I was like, okay. And then Alex was like, no, 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 it's not going to be bar food. I was like, okay. And then I look at the kitchen. I was like, oh, my God, this is like the size of a station.
Mm-hmm. It's small. Yeah.
And then I was like, well, but if I'm good at what I do, I should be able to make it work.
Yeah.
Because you know what I think is like, if you were in this environment and if you learned something that was right, it's about how you make that work.
Because
mm-hmm. that's what we do. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, there's no dishwasher. How do I make my day work?
Right.
It was the same.
Yeah.
So I just did what I had to do.
But when you took all the experience you had and mm-hmm. the kind of vision you had for as much as you had it for what you wanted to do, mm-hmm. how did you have to adapt it to this opportunity that came up? I mean, you're not doing a tasting menu here.
No, I'm not, because that would be crazy. I thought about it for Sundays, but then it's still crazy. I just look at the space.
Mm-hmm.
I think even though I come from the very uptight, fancy, posh, annoying mm-hmm. background, I was like, okay, I need to analyze the space.
Yeah.
And I think all my experience between Justin, Paul, Matt, England, you know, Australia, yeah. it's like, you need to understand the space. And it's a hard thing to, sometimes it's a hard thing to accept, but it's funny because sometimes also I think it's very helpful. Because mm-hmm. if I had a blank canvas and yeah. I had this like white page in front of me and I'd be like, you can do whatever you want.
Right.
I'll be like, oh my God. Right. So it's like, where do I go? And I've been thinking about it. So where do I go when I have like, there's no limit.
Right.
It's so scary because I don't know how I would go about it.
So this gave you structure.
Yeah. So it gives me limits. So I have to be like, yeah, of course. You know, I have to be like, okay, so it's, even though there was nothing like this on the walls, I was like, oh, I find it dark. If it's mm-hmm. dark, it's sexy.
Mm-hmm.
If it's small, it's intimate.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a speakeasy and a bar. I can't be super fancy,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't know what to do. So it's like, you know, I knew there's some things make sense. There's no windows. And I was like, yeah, burger makes sense here. A tartare, yeah, of course. And then it was like empty canvas. I was like, yeah, oysters, you know? So I keep thinking about like the writers that were coming here, people playing chess. I look at this picture. So I just got inspired, not even by doing research, but the things that they were like shown to me or they were like laying around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the menu came up. And also the kitchen. You know, the kitchen is small.
Yeah.
There's too many restrictions. There's no end. It's like a box. It uh-huh. really is literally a galley.
Yeah.
Someone wants to run out. They cannot.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, okay, so how do I make this work consistently? And I think Michelin gave me that, which is like consistency.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to have the same burger on Wednesday that you're going to have on Friday, that you're going to have on Saturday. Yeah. And I try to do that. I know sometimes it's hard for things to come out that way, but I want things to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, so how do I work my menu that way?
Right.
So that's how I think every day.
Yeah. Do you think about it as more than, I don't know how to say this, more than cooking? It seems like the way you're talking about it, it does almost seem to me like a writerly approach to what you do. In that there, a certain amount of it is, it's about mood. It's about contact.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the space. You know, when I was at Alimentari, I thought the space was wild and green.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this like the mood of the moment, you know? Yeah. So I go to a market and I used to have this, there was a lunch menu going on. Okay, so I can do a broccoli wrap with whatever and people will be fine.
Yeah.
And something that I would like, but it would be like super like, oh, you know, let's do this and that. Oh, great.
Yeah.
But here is like, A, it's my name. And I want someone, even if they don't like it, to judge me for who I am.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a mood. It is an inspiration. It is a thought. There's a feeling all the time. And I think it's very, even though someone said to me that I have a very male, like, flavor, someone says, like, your flavors are so bold. And I was like, it's like a man was cooking. Or someone was, like, was surprised that it was a woman. I was like, oh, my God, that's awful. But, you know, it's a moment. Yeah, it's a mood. You know, it's like how I feel, what I saw.
Yeah.
But the moment I have a disconnection, then I stop and then I put it away.
That's so funny someone said that to you.
Yeah, no, someone said that to me. Someone
said
that
doesn't make sense to you, does it?
Not really. I was like, I mean, it made sense when someone said to me that sometimes I can be so feminine, but at the same time I can be so like a savage or like so, what's it, like raw and strong, blah, blah. So, you know, I think I'm a very strong person. I have a strong personality, but I see myself as a woman and a very feminine person.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's funny. I don't know. I mean, your food to me, I hope this doesn't sound wrong. Or, you know, I think it's very pretty.
I well, that's great.
So if I was going to talk about, I mean, I'm not really analyzing the flavor, but I mean, to me, I don't know. That comment doesn't make sense to me. But where do you stand on this whole question of food as art? Do you consider it to be that?
I think it's only the only reason why I think it, I sometimes I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think that when I hear that, it's like, oh, that sounds so obnoxious because we're not, I'm not Gauguin, I'm not Degas.
Yeah.
I admire a lot of painters, and you know, I have a tattoo on my back by Afro-Cuban, and I think it's amazing, and I would have never done that. Probably, but I only think it's art because you're trying to express yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you make a statement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that comes out all the time out of my kitchen as a painting.
Mm-hmm.
So why not consider that art?
Right.
Now, whether it's the art form to be so sublime and amazing like Gauguin, I don't think so.
Right. But there's an element of it for you.
There is an element because, you know, you're trying to put yourself out there.
Yep.
I mean, I'm giving you myself when something comes out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
Even with the fries, those fries are part of myself.
Well, this now brings it around. You know, I surrendered on the burger debate. But that actually makes more sense to me after this conversation because, you know, if you take what you're saying, then to modify that.
You're trying to modify me.
Yeah. Is that how you look at it?
Yeah. I was like, why? There's so many other places and other personalities you can go to. So if you want to come here, then you're trying to have a taste of me.
Right.
Which, you know, I am more than happy to give you that. And some people might disagree, and it's fine. And, you know, every time when I'm doing pre-shift, I sit down and I said, you know, the food has a very a specific view and flavor profile and blah, blah, blah. And I say to them, sometimes, you know, it's funny. I don't think they're listening to me, but I say, you know, I'm giving you a lot of myself.
Yeah.
And it's a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting journey that I take all the time.
Yeah.
Because it's the same thing like you. It's like, oh, I have this personality. It's like, I don't know that. It's my first restaurant.
Right.
So I'm trying to find myself.
Yeah.
So I try to find myself in every dish.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I said to him, it's like, sometimes it might change because I change.
Right.
So if I don't change with something, I'm not always the same.
Yeah.
So sometimes you might see that the fat is different, but there's always an element of fat. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, okay. But if you're listening carefully, it's almost like describing who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to sound special, but that's what every chef does. It's like there's a profile of flavors and notes and sounds, and there's a look that defines who you are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember when Paul Lebrun said to me, at Atera, he's like, oh, this menu seems this and this and that. And he was very happy about it. And I was like, but he's like, but it makes sense. People grow.
Yeah.
And one time he came here, I think it was like his fourth time, and I was very upset at him, but he doesn't know. But he comes in as I'm walking, as like the third time, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe he can't text me.
Yeah.
So he sits down and he's like, I love the way the menu is looking right now.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, seems like you. You know, those things are very hard for me to give to you and you like be able to listen.
Yeah.
Because you have to be open.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we're open all the time.
Yeah.
To be open to the chef of like, yeah, this is the voice. Are you listening to it? Or are you listening to the noise in the dining room? Yeah. Or,
you know. I mean, I will tell you, you and I had this talk about the burger, right? Because yeah, my view has always been, and it's because I had, I knew chefs early in my writing career who felt like, you know, whatever the customer wants, I'll do it, right? But I will say, sitting here having this conversation with you, I am persuaded to relent because uh-huh, I do understand what you're saying. This to me goes to this ongoing question that I've been thinking about a lot this season of art, the art piece. This mm-hmm, is kind of saying, you know, yes, it's a meal and yes, you're eating it and yes, you know, but you know, one of the things you are coming to a restaurant for is to experience that chef's point of view.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes what's hard here is New York. You know, yeah, like, I love the city. I've been here for 8 years, and I never feel part of a city. I'm not even my own country.
Yeah.
And I love how New York moves and it feels and blah, blah. But it's hard because there's a money issue.
Mm-hmm.
And money is not sexy when it needs to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Money is sexy when you want to throw money and not, have, not care right, about you money.
Have an endless supply of
yeah,
it.
And you yeah, want to have fun right, with money. But we need to care about money, be like, you know, dollar amount is yeah, something. And there's a meaning. Then you're like stressed out. New York is hard. And the state in general, you know, I had this conversation with a really good close friend of mine.
Yeah.
My friend from Chile in Borago, he had this book and from Fidon, 90% of the book is about like his upbringing. And I was like, how many someone wrote this? You know, some people do care about the art.
Yeah.
And thank God for that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's what's going to keep someone else to be like, you know what? I want to be a cook. Right. I want to be a chef.
Right. Yep.
There's a dream. We all dream. I dream every day.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's what it is.
Great. Thanks for staying late with me tonight. And thanks for the drink.
The couple drinks, yes.
And that's our show. A huge thank you to Victoria Blamey of Chumley's for being a good enough sport and a good enough friend to stay late after a long day. We left that restaurant and turned the key in the lock at about 2 in the morning. And I really appreciated it, Victoria. Thank you very much. And for everyone listening, I hope you will go and patronize the restaurant. I think Victoria's food there is just great. And I also like everything else they do there. I also need to make a correction. At the beginning of the show, I referred to this awesome shrimp dish that was a special the night we were there. I said it was a shrimp with ponzu sauce. It was shrimp with sambal sauce. If it wasn't a 10-minute intro, I would have retaped it. But I wasn't going to retape it to fix that word, so I'm just letting you guys know that. And I should also say, when I was talking about diversity, I meant to make mention of the fact that I would also like to have a greater diversity of sexual orientation among our guests, and that too is something that I'm working on. So again, I am trying to pay my respect to all of the different people who make up this community and make up the larger community. And that is something that you will be seeing in the weeks and months to come. And it is something that I'm very cognizant of, and not just because of listener comments. It's something that I've always been very devoted to. So that said, I want to thank David Tatasciore, our engineer, for splicing this thing together. David, thank you. And a reminder, as always, if you'd like to follow the show, we are at Chef Podcast. That's at Chef Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can follow me personally at Toqueland Andrew, Toqueland Andrew. And that's also Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. That's our show for this week. Or I should say that's our show for today, since we're dropping these at a slightly greater rate right now. So we'll see you back here soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Thanks so much for listening.